Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. April 1st, 1971. 50 years ago today, WITF-FM signed on the air for the first time.
Good morning. This is WITF-FM, public radio in Hershey, Pennsylvania, signing on the air for its first day of regular broadcasting. Here is Dr. Gilmore Sievers, president of the South Central Educational Broadcasting Council, the licensee of WITF-FM.
I am delighted to welcome all residents of South Central Pennsylvania to the first day of broadcasting by WITF-FM. The aim of this station will be similar to that of Channel 33, to provide an alternative FM radio service, broadcasting the best in music, drama, public affairs, information, and light entertainment.
That was from the April 1st, 1971 broadcast, the first words spoken on this station. On today's Smart Talk, we'll discuss the radio station's first 50 years, how it began, the role it has played in the community, and highlight several of the historic news events during that time period and how the station's journalists reported on them. Joining us up front are WITF's president and CEO Ron Hetrick and Susan Eckert, the chair of WITF's board of directors. I want to welcome both of you to the program. Ron, I want to start with you. Over the past 50 years, only a handful of people have sat in your chair as president and CEO. Now, I have to think that that stability is one of the reasons that WITF has been so successful. Knowing the history and where the station is today, reflect on your thoughts about 50 years of WITF radio.
Well, thanks, Scott. And it is so exciting to be able to celebrate the 50th anniversary of WITF-FM with all of you today. I am humbled and inspired by the foresight that my predecessors have had in terms of the role that public media can mean in our community. As we think about how WITF started with WITF-TV back in 1963 and 64, and then in 1971 to take a chance and think about what public radio could mean, this brand new medium that we weren't sure we wanted to get into, and to be able to shape that into the service that it is now, and to be thinking about the educational impact, the impact that it can have on the arts and culture community, and just everything that is developed as we've learned from the community over the years has just been really, it's been inspirational for me and keeps me level set when thinking about where to take WITF in the future.
When you say learn from the community, what do you mean by that?
Well, this is the community's public radio station, and it is imperative that we learn and listen. We want to reflect the voices of our community through our programming. We want to know that what we're talking about and what we're covering are of interest. We want to help bridge that divide. Think of us as the window to the world in many ways, and we want to make sure that we're providing the right framing to make sure that, again, we're connecting with people in our community and what they want to know from us.
One of the things we heard with that original sign-on was we were hearing from the South Central Educational Broadcasting Council. The station started as an educator. And I know that you still look at it that way, and we're not just talking about the radio station, but the talk about WITF as an educator.
Absolutely. We like to think about us as being inspiring lifelong learning. From the early days of birth until, later in life, we want to, provide information and context in ways that are educating for all of those different stakeholders. So certainly on the WITF-TV side, we have rich programming through our WITF, through PBS Kids and those resources. As you get older, we have just rich programming across the board between Nature and Nova and the documentaries and the entertainment programming on PBS. But we also have on the NPR side, the whole public and civic discourse that takes place between the news and between informative programming and insights. And then, of course, as you get later on in life, we have different ways to inspire ongoing learning and the curiosity that exists in much of our audience. So really, we educate across the board. And it just is a very simple way to describe the many wonderful services that WITF and public media brings to the community.
Susan Eckert is chair of the WITF Board of Directors. You know, I've always been curious. I've been at WITF almost 30 years in different capacities. And the board, you know, we've always heard what the board thinks. But I'm curious as to a board chair. How do you view WITF-FM?
Oh, I view it as a precious resource, something that really adds a dimension to the commuting life, which I see regularly and hear regularly from my husband. As soon as he gets in the car to commute, he's listening. And I think it's really a treasure. Even and now I hear more and more people listening to WITF on their computers while they're working. So to me, it's a calm, refreshing, and balanced reporting, which enriches the life of all of us who listen.
Is there a responsibility as chair, as a member of the board of directors? Do you feel a responsibility for maintaining and really thinking through any kind of changes an institution in the community like WITF has made or will make?
Oh, absolutely. It really is our obligation to, as individuals, represent the community on the board and respectfully represent the community, understanding that no one of us really is the only representative. It's only when you look at the breadth and diversity of the board that we become a convincing subset of what the community is like. We've got to look at geography and make sure we have a fairly large listening and viewing area. So we need to make sure that we represent the geography, the diversity, and the interests of the community.
Hey, Ron, that sign on from April 1st, 1971 talked about being in Hershey. Even today, even though WITF hasn't been in Hershey at the Hershey Theater for a long time, I still, from time to time, will hear someone ask a question about, are you guys still in Hershey? How about you? You hear that?
All the time, Scott, you know, especially being a resident of downtown Hershey, you know, I hear that from my neighbors and peers all the time. And, yeah, for some people, it will always be the Hershey Bay Station.
We have a question from a listener wanted to know, and Ron, I'll put this to you. What are you most proud of in the 50 years of WITF?
It's a great question. You know, I would say that the way that WITF has evolved to respond to the needs of the community and the changing technologies that have basically transcended and taken over our lives in many ways. I read a quote yesterday that the message chooses the medium, and the message of WITF, you know, really has chosen the medium over time, starting with TV and radio in the very beginning, having a magazine for many years, and now evolving to the many different digital platforms that we engage with. While we're not on TikTok now, you know, there are many other digital platforms that we're engaged with and testing out. And again, connecting our people, connecting people and convening people in the community on the platforms where they are at. So really that spirit of innovation that has transcended WITF's history and even inspires us as we look towards the future.
Ron, one final question. The last year has been unlike any other in the previous 49 at WITF-FM. But yet we have found ways to adapt and continue to try to serve the community. Talk about the last year and how much of a challenge it has been for the station.
So it's been a time of great resilience and a time of innovation for WITF. You know, surrounded by our wonderful staff, you know, and all the different services that we provide, you know, especially on the radio side in the spirit of today, being that connecting point around the pandemic, around the election, and just being that constant source of information is, you know, driven the staff to, you know, rise to the occasion, to want to make a difference and know that we have an important role to play in the community. On the education side, we've been very fortunate in terms of establishing new partnerships in ways that WITF never has before. And that's been another inspiring all team effort to basically help improve access to digital and educational information for children in our communities across the state. And now we're helping across the nation. So, the last year has certainly had its challenges. It's had its sadness. But at the end of the day, for WITF, it's been a time of growth and change that will have a long-term impact in the future.
WITF's President and CEO Ron Hetrick and Susan Eckert, the Chair of WITF's Board of Directors, thank you very much for being with us today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The music you just heard is Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. It was part of WITF-FM's sign-on in 1971. So how did WITF-FM come to be? And what changes did the station go through over the years? Two people who were there are with us today. Michael Ziegler was the executive vice president of WITF and was instrumental in getting the station on the air. And Mitzi Trostel was the station's, let me list several of her titles: traffic coordinator and classical music announcer, program director, director of radio, and vice president of multimedia content and distribution. I talked about the stability that WITF has had. It means that there are people, and a lot of people, that have been with the station for a long time. Thank you both for being with us today. Mike Ziegler, I want to start with you because you were there at the very beginning. And I know this is kind of a long story, but I'll ask you for the brief version of how the idea was planted for a radio station and how it came to be.
Well, it was a time of enormous change in what was up to then educational television and educational radio. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 provided funding to set up the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to authorize PBS, NPR, and Interconnection Service. So there was a new birth, really, that was going on at that time. And the whole idea of creating a multimedia kind of environment was just getting started. WITF had been doing multimedia projects on television, Time to Act, Interact, Time of Our Lives.
Those are programs.
Really interesting community involvement programs. So it was just natural that we would progress into the new media of public radio.
So, the idea was planted. And I know you talked about it amongst yourselves with managers and staff. How did the station actually come to be? How did it get on the air? What led up to that April 1st, 1971 sign-on?
A lot of it was in finding the best possible staff to start it up. And we were fortunate that a radio station in New York City that had had a classical music format had been sold and changed its format. So we hired what was then the general manager of that station, Walter Shepard, and he brought with him some very talented people, had a lot of industry contacts. So it was easy to staff up. The other thing that made it really easy was that WITF had an existing structure: management, financial, graphics even, and a whole organizational setup. So we could just sort of plug radio into that. We found space in the third floor of the Hershey Community Center and went through the process of getting a license and all that, figured out how to fund it, and it all came together rather quickly. Bob Larson had a little convincing to do. I dragged him to Washington once, and we met with some people at CPP, and he became a convert. And on the way back, we talked about all the things that could happen. I had put TV stations on air in West Virginia and in Charlotte, North Carolina. And that music that started that first broadcast was the same music I had used on the previous stations. So, there was an environment of people that were ready to do it, hit the ground with your feet running. And we had great support from the board. It was almost an evolutionary thing rather than something that was just born out of nothing. It was the next logical step.
Just a couple of things. Bob Larson, former general manager, president of WITF at that time, and CPD is a corporation for public broadcasting. So, Mike, I'm curious, how did you settle on a classical music format?
Well, it really was just about the only alternative. There was no classical music in the market, Harrisburg, Lancaster, York. Closest classical music station was in Philadelphia, WFLN, so it wasn't already there. We talked a lot about an informational format, but the resources just weren't there. NPR wouldn't get started with programming for almost another year, and there were nothing like the resources that are now available to put together an informational talk format. So it was almost a default judgment, but it filled a niche. It filled a need in the community. And as Susan Eckert said, the role of the station is to reflect the needs of the community and to respond to them. And it was an obvious need. And it was made possible, really, because the only alternative wouldn't become possible until the years later.
Hmm. So tell me about those early days. Radio 50 years ago was much different than it was today, but especially for a public broadcaster 50 years ago. Tell me about those early days.
Well, for one thing, almost everything was live. Very, very little was pre-recorded. The music was played real time. No such things, obviously, as computer files and recording segments in advance. So it was a real time enterprise. And it was linear. It was one thing at a time. It wasn't a, a hodgepodge. It had a lot of focus to it, and beyond that, it was programming that really the audience responded very, very well to, and we were very pleased with the response that we got from the audience. It also created an opportunity to do a lot of cross programming with radio promoting television productions and TV. Always building in to a production, a radio element. Radio was also used to supplement television in technical ways too. This was before high quality audio was possible on television. So for concert programs, the soundtrack was on the radio station and the video of a concert was obviously broadcast on TV. So there's a lot of cross work. We operated as a joint enterprise. It was one staff. It wasn't two separate staffs. And constantly we talked about what's the best way to communicate this message. You know, what medium is really appropriate? Is it print? Is it television? Is it radio? Is it some kind of a community outreach venture?
So I have to ask this question because I know all of us who will be on this show today are storytellers at heart. Do you have a memory that really sticks out about those early days, Mike?
Well, maybe not a lot of them, but maybe not so many that I should go public with.
We always say that.
I get that.
This was a group of highly creative people working very close together, doing a lot of really good work. And some of the stories probably don't bear repeating.
Well, let me turn to Mitzi Trosel. Mitzi was one of the longest employed. I don't know, that sounds so formal, Mitzi, but when I listed all the titles you had, if you had hats for each one, your closet would have been full. Mitzi Trosel started at WITF in 1981 and was with the station up until 2011. Mitzi, you just said you heard that about the stories that we can't repeat, but tell us how you got involved with WITF FM.
How did I get involved, Scott?
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you, I started as a volunteer in Hershey in the mid-70s, and I really will try to keep this brief and concise. And one thing led to another. I got to know Mike Greenwald through my volunteer work, and a job opened up in the membership department, actually. And lo and behold, I applied for the job and got it. So I spent my first 2 years in membership and then moved to radio. And I guess what led me there was I was the kid that grew up with no television. My parents didn't trust television, and I was about 10 until we got one. And then the only thing I was allowed to watch was WITF television. Then the radio station came along. I also happened to play the piano and take lessons very seriously. And I got my degree in music and performance. And so classical music and WITF television from radio and television were really the background of my life. And from the age of 10 up, WITF meant everything to me. And just the fact is, I love what Mike said, because, man, this, you know, I was the little hippie kid that kind of never left those days. And Mike said that public broadcasting was born as a kind of revolutionary idea. And indeed it was. And it was the alternative. It was where you went when you couldn't find what you were looking for. And so that was always so appealing to me. When NPR started, my God, they had women, the three or four or five women, the lead, ships in the water at NPR were women just as well as they were men. And so it was really groundbreaking at the time. The other thing Mike said that I loved was that it was not only revolutionary, but it was fresh. There was a lot of movement. Kennedy was president and kind of got the whole thing started, and, you know, the civil rights movement and the women's movement, and it just all started moving, and public radio and public television moved with it. And so because I love classical music and, you know, serious content, that's what led me there, even as a volunteer.
You know, Mitzi, now we've been talking about classical music, and that was the main format of the station. But
yeah,
I've used the word eclectic to describe what WITF-FM has done over the years, because it was not strictly a classical music format. I mean, there was folk, there was jazz, and I had to laugh. You sent a message to me just the other day about a Grateful Dead hour. I mean, where did that mixture come from?
Well, as Mike said, again, I think all the people that we're talking with today understand this deeply. And I really, truly have always prayed and hoped that the community does too. There is one thing that we have always kept in mind at all times. It's the highest God I ever served. And that is the community. It's public service. And if we were not providing a service that the majority of people could use and wanted and knew where to turn to get it, we would have just been nowhere. So yes, it was the norm for classical music and some jazz across the country to be on the air, be programmed as public radio was being born. But then as taste changed and public radio grew, the options in programming grew. So lo and behold, we went from classical and jazz to folk, to rock. I believe our David Walker even did a rock show at one time. Am I right, Mike, on WITF radio? I forget what it was called. And so we had African music, we had Celtic music, and it was across the board. So the goal at that point was, we have this air, we're going to pick the smartest programming that we can get, and we'll serve the masses. And that worked for a while. But then guess what? Radio started changing again, and people started changing again, and their wants started changing. And we found out that eventually we were trying to be too many things to too many people. And we were serving fewer and fewer people. The people that would turn into the Grateful Dead Hour were thrilled for 1 hour a week. But then when something else came on, guess what? They went away, or they went to their records. And so as we had the luxury of not being tied so much into research, as commercial stations live and breathe by, of course, but as public radio became more sophisticated and the need to serve the public in greater amounts, became the goal, we learned to look at a little bit of research and to become experts at reading it and to see we may be shooting ourselves in the foot. We love our pipe organ people. We love our classical music people. We love our metropolitan opera people. We love all of those people, but we cannot exist. We always had an eye to the future. As Mike said, we were laying the ground for the Ron Hetricks and the people of this day, the Scott Gilbert, the Scott Lamars, there's too many Scots, and the Tim Lamberts. So we evolved to keep up with the public, and then we had some very big events, news-related events, both locally and globally and across the country. We'll talk about those more later in the program, that really started to tip the pendulum, if you will, toward news and information. And I'm talking a lot, Scott. I'm going to shut up and let you lead back. But there's one thing that, it's not my program. There's one thing that I really hope we'll touch upon, maybe when the news guys join us. In my opinion, there was one huge, huge groundbreaking shift between the classical and the music side, and that occurred, that those doors opened wide during September 11th.
Right.
And music played a vitally critical role. So we'll talk about the healing effect that music had later and the brilliant programming that Dick Strasser, our music director then, and our other classical announcers brought to help to heal this area. But that was the point when I remember standing in a hallway with Bo Balmer, who was my news director then, and we were both in a fever pitch. And I said, just so you know, Bo, we are giving up classical music right now for as long as we have to, and we're joining NPR. And we were doing that through the years. There were many times when we dropped the classical music for a week or so to do congressional hearings or whatever. We always served two main gods and then many, many others. But it came to a point where the world shifted, this area started to shift, and we knew what we had to do. We had to respect all the other gods, but we had to serve the community primarily through local news and information and world news through the BBC and NPR.
Well, Mitzi, I'm going to keep you around, and Mike, too. Mike Ziegler was the station manager at WITF-FM. Mitzi Trosel held a lot of different positions. Going to keep him on the air, but we're going to talk about news next. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're marking WITF-FM's 50th birthday today, or the anniversary of the station's first broadcast on April 1st, 1971. Obviously, a lot of history has been made in central Pennsylvania, in Pennsylvania, and across the country since 1971. Hurricane Agnes created havoc with historic flooding in the region in 1972. The Three Mile Island accident and partial meltdown in 1979 was the worst at an American commercial nuclear power plant. Eventually, WITF became an affiliate of National Public Radio and ramped up its own news department. We're joined now by four of the five last news directors, Ed Ark, Damon Balmer, Scott Gilbert, and our current multimedia news director, Tim Lambert. But I'm going to talk first with Mitzi Trostel again. Mitzi, where you left us before the break was talking about those changes. You were instrumental in ramping up WITF's local, regional, and state news. Talk about that, if you will.
Yeah, well, as I said, we, and it, you know, obviously it's we collectively, but we saw the tide turning. And I one thing I'm really proud of, we had a lot of partners in the community, and I came on board knowing nothing about broadcasting. I was, you know, I was a musician essentially, and certainly didn't know anything about, you know, the news world, other than I knew what I wanted to consume and what the junk was that I didn't. And so I just started making phone calls. And this was even really before email was, you know, was up and running to any great extent. And so my best buddies became my counterparts and the news directors at other Pennsylvania stations. So I was talking to WHYY a lot and various other stations across the country. And God, one of the news guys can help me here. I am getting old. I'll be 63 in July. What was the news director's name? Oh, Fantini, Bill Fantini, right? I think. And so I think it was Bill and I that sort of started to punt around the idea of a partnership of news stations and how, you know, together we could do more than we are singly. And it took a while to get to that point, but we developed almost an entire other network, if you will. And Bo can talk about this, various people we implanted, if you will, down at the Capitol and started to share reporters. So these were just the seeds that were planted from phone calls, because we were still doing classical music and all the other stuff. But I knew somehow, and also by talking to people that really did know what they were doing as I was a kid and was learning from them, that we would have to start to look in this direction. And I should say, as I did a while ago, more and more offerings were coming up. Public radio nationally through Public Radio International and American Public Radio and NPR, et cetera, et cetera. Even Pacifica, networks like that, were growing, taking on staff, and offering so much more in terms of programming. And we just knew it was our job to talk and to know that, you know, you have to look ahead.
And ARC was one of the...
I'm sorry?
No, I was going to bring in Ed, Ed ARC, because Ed was one of the first news directors. Ed, I don't know if you started in the late 80s, but I know in the early 90s, Ed ARC now is at Messiah College as a professor teaching the next generation of broadcasters out there. But Ed, talk about those early days of news on WITF-FM. What was it like?
Sure. In the early 90s, Scott, like Mitzi was talking about, programs like Morning Edition and All Things Considered were really becoming, you know, gold standards across the country. And so WITF was slowly but surely building the foundation for news and information. As Mike pointed out, back in the early years, we had one staff. So at that time, we were doing television news, the 33 report. And we on radio relied on a lot of the television reporters to go out and cover stories and gather audio that we used then on radio. So we were sharing resources back then. And we began doing news breaks during the news magazines, but also hourly updates as the start of each hour of classical music. Another thing that we were doing back in the 90s was beginning to build this sort of statewide network of public radio stations across the country that Mitzi was talking about. At that time, we had the Pennsylvania Public Television Network, and so all of the stations were interconnected, both TV and we could do audio as well. So, for example, in 1994, we anchored statewide coverage of the Rolf Larson impeachment hearings in Harrisburg and shared that with public radio stations across the state. So this idea of collaboration has been sort of growing momentum for quite some time now.
As Mitzi mentioned, 9/11 was a turning point for so many in this country, but especially, from a personal perspective, and when I say personal, meaning a collective at WITF, it was a big point. Damon Bobaumer was the news director at that time, and Bo, I remember that morning when the whole staff, and not just news, but everyone got together talking about how we were going to be covering this, the biggest story in our lifetimes, for sure. Talk about 9/11 and that morning and how WITF-FM covered that story from a local angle.
Yeah, Scott, I remember I was not in the station right at 9 o'clock because that morning, halfway between, I was living in Elizabethtown at the time, and halfway between me and the station was there was a new ramp off 283 that was opening, and I was going to cover a 9 a.m. press conference. But I got a phone call from our then morning edition local host, Justin Gilkin, a couple minutes before that was happening, and I just kept on driving right into the station. And we went from, a very ordinary morning into 24-hour, nonstop presentation of all of the information that we could get our hands on within that first 30 to 45 minutes. And it's weird to think about now, but we did have that sort of brief moment at the beginning of should we stay with the news? Should we, but it became quite clear pretty quickly that that our obligation to the community was going to be to provide everything locally and regionally that we could to supplement what was happening at the national level. We were talking about everything from Harrisburg City Schools deciding to keep their kids at the school because they felt it was the safest and most orderly thing to do at the time, to could the stacks at Three Mile Island withstand a plane impact, to, eventually as the afternoon wore on, the downing of one of the planes in Somerset County, Pennsylvania. It was really a day that changed the country. It changed what we were doing at WITF to serve the mid-state.
Tim Lambert has a couple ties to 9/11. Tim is our current multimedia news director. Tim's family owned part of the land where Flight 93 did crash. So in those early days, Tim did a lot of reporting on the families of the passengers on Flight 93 and had an insight that many journalists, maybe no other journalist had into 9/11 and Flight 93 in particular. But Tim, one of the things that you've done over the years, because out of 9/11 came war in Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, and you've reported on many of the mid-state soldiers and people in the military and those who have served. And I want to play, this is just a snippet of a story you did on a local soldier who lost his life in Iraq, Keith Bennett. Let's listen to this.
National Guard spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Chris Cleaver later said the 32-year-old military policeman died a hero and saved the lives of dozens of people because he blocked the vehicle from getting inside.
The quick actions of Sergeant Bennett stopped the vehicle, and the insurgent knew he was not going to get any further.
Bennett, who was serving with the 2nd Brigade Combat Team, 28th Infantry Division, had been with the Guard since 1997. He left behind his mom, stepdad, and his sister. Today, we travel to Holtwood to meet with them in the first installment of a three-part series from WITF News, Families of the Fallen, a look at how mid-state families who've lost loved ones in the war are dealing with their grief.
Carolyn Miller, Keith's mom.
I'm Tom Miller, I'm Keith's stepfather.
Tina Daly, Keith Bennett's sister.
The three are sitting in the living room of the Miller's home in the southern part of Lancaster County, a room that prominently features several pictures of Keith. Their story is just a small snapshot of how the war has created a void in the lives of more than 2,400 families across the country that may never be filled. Both Carolyn and Tom vividly recall the moment on that December night when their stepson told them a chaplain and an Army officer were downstairs.
Man, I'll tell you what.
I knew right then.
It was a long way down the stairs.
I don't remember coming down the stairs.
And they were standing right about where you were sitting and standing at attention. Mm-hmm. And he said, We're sorry to inform you that Sergeant Keith Bennett and both of us just lost it right there.
Tim, there are several things about just that story that stick out that I think sets WITF FM apart. Number one is that just the length of the story. Now, that was just a snippet of it. But if I remember correctly, it was about 7 minutes long, that we have the opportunity and we can do something that commercial radio stations don't do, in that we go in depth. But you visited the home of Sergeant Keith Bennett, talked to his family. You got to hear that emotion in their voices. And, you know, even though there are so many people who count on video today and visuals, still, when you're picturing it in your mind, I think it even has a bigger impact. Tell me about how that story evolved and what was the thinking behind it?
Yeah, that clip just brought me right back to their living room and listening to that story. And it's an emotional story. It's probably one of the best stories I think I've ever produced. And it all started, we were doing a year-end review of the number of National Guardsmen who were killed in Iraq that year in December. And I came across an interview I had done with Sergeant Bennett the previous August before he shipped off, when I went down to Camp Shelby in Mississippi for the deployment ceremony. And I heard the tape and I turned to our news director, Scott Gilbert, and I was like, I interviewed Keith Bennett. And then right around the same time, his sister reached out to me and asked me if I had tape of that interview, because she remembered he had talked to us. And so we just emailed back and forth, and I asked, hey, can I come down and talk to you and your family? And they were so warm and open to share, you know, in their grief, and just, you know, spent the afternoon with them in Holtwood, Lancaster County. And they just shared so much with me, and just, you know, you could hear how they played off each other and the emotion in their voices, and they just gave me so much material to work with. And it was an honor to you know, work on that story and write that story, and really spent 7.5 minutes to show the impact of how the war in Iraq is impacting families here in central Pennsylvania.
Let's turn to another story, and this was a tragic story as well. Both Scott Gilbert and Damon Bo Baumer were involved in reporting the story, the shooting at an Amish schoolhouse in Lancaster County. Let's go back to listen to both Scott and Damon.
Police received a call around 10 o'clock this morning from the teacher at West Nickel Mines Amish School in Bart Township. Now, here's what we know at this point. Three young girls have been confirmed dead. Police identify the shooter as Charles Carl Roberts of Bart Township. WITF Scott Gilbert is at the scene. Now, Scott, if you can, describe what you're seeing right now.
Well, picture rolling farmland, a very, very rural setting, but marred with police cars, with ambulances, with police tape up around a really very, very large crime scene that spans several acres.
WITF Scott Gilbert reporting from Bart Township. We're joined now by WITF's Damon Baumer, who's at Hershey Medical Center. Damon, what do we know at this point?
There are three girls at Hershey Medical Center. The oldest is 13. She's still in surgery, or was at 4:30. There is a 6-year-old. There is an 8-year-old. Both of them are out of surgery. They are at pediatric ICU. All three described as in critical condition with very serious wounds.
Well, that was a tragic day in central Pennsylvania, but both Scott and Bo were involved in that story. Scott, one of the things that really stuck out to me, and again, it is something that WITF-FM News has done over the years, is your description of the scene put the listener there. Talk about that day.
Well, you know, Scott, I think it's very easy in situations like this to focus on numbers, you know, to talk about the raw data, how many have been shot, how many have been killed. But to paint that full picture and to take you into the community and to introduce you to the people who are affected by it. I mean, just like Tim's story on Keith Bennett did, you know, it's really no different when you cover something like the Amish school shootings. That said, I mean, I can't say I've ever covered anything like that before. It was by far the most terrible and tragic story I covered in my 14-year career in journalism. But I think it is about, like you say, Scott, that the public radio can bring to a story like this, that additional context, that additional perspective of what the setting is like, you know, the broader perspective beyond just the numbers and what may be in the police report.
Bo, you were at the Penn State's Hershey Medical Center at the time. I mean, this is not the kind of story that WITF covered on a regular basis. I mean, we didn't do automobile crashes. We didn't do murders for the most part on a daily basis. But obviously, this was something that was historic, not just here in Pennsylvania, but nationwide. What was it like there at the hospital waiting for that information?
It was tough. And in fact, I was my later assignment later in the day was to find out in the evening and nighttime hours how the community was responding, which was a difficult story to tell, considering that Amish and many Anabaptist communities shun radio and television and electronic media. And so I was trying to figure out how to tell the story without being able to talk to them, and finding neighbors and acquaintances to try to get some insight. And in fact, I was telling my girlfriend just this morning that something that stood out to me listening back to the coverage was that what WITF has been able to do for most or all of its 50 years is to tell the stories of things happening in central Pennsylvania with great humanity and to allow people to understand and interpret the things that are happening in a really human way. You're right. We don't, WITF doesn't chase ambulances. We don't, you know, it's not sensational coverage. And that was a story that could have been told in that way. And you know, as I think probably as it was told in some places nationally in 5 and 10 second sound bites, that's probably what people saw. They saw a couple of flashing police car lights, and they didn't see what Scott saw on the ground. They didn't see what, you know, Tim and Eric Wellman and I and others reporting on it in the days that followed saw. And so it was a privilege to be able to try to tell that story in a way that respected the community, that respected our listeners, and that injected some humanity into a really difficult, just one of the most tragic things that I can think of that's happened in central Pennsylvania.
You know, we only have a minute or so left, but these stories that we've been talking about, what did they mean to the listeners? Bo, Scott?
I think Bo's point about humanity, it brings the human touch. As storytellers, that's what we want to do, is make human connections. And having the luxury of a little more time to tell the stories allows WITF to make those human connections.
And by the way, having the listeners who appreciate it too. That's, you know, we tell the stories and we wouldn't be able to do it without listener support. And so that's an infinitely valuable thing that we hear from.
And let's be honest. I mean, it's easy to get sound bites from public officials, right? It's easy to go out on any kind of story and get a public official, someone who's up for re-election, to give a sound bite. It's harder to go out into communities and get authentic voices of real people. And I think that that's what WITF brings to central Pennsylvania. No one else is doing that on the radio, and it's great to hear it continue to this day.
Ed Ark, Damon Balmer, Scott Gilbert, and our current multimedia news director, Tim Lambert. We probably could go on all day, but I want to thank you for the memories. Thank you for the work that you've done on WITF, and I hope the community appreciates the work that we all have done here on WITF over the years. Thank you for being with us. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.